Philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Backwards, fast as we can. Really put the pedal to the metal, you know? Bill and Ted did it.
Giant crabs descend upon Detroit, rebuild failing infrastructure, and revitalize downtown.
That would be so grand.
Greeks, probably. Greeks. Greeks talk a whole bunch of nonsense.
Oh, don't worry, Greg.
It's a nice safe space where you don't have to pretend to like Hamilton.
I like Hamilton.
Sure you do. We all do.
Hello and welcome to episode 178, Philosophers in Space. Go kill Aaron, everybody. You need to kill Aaron. Go kill Aaron. That's I'm going to insert a fleshy floppy disk. I don't know. A piece of a cassette.
I think it would be a USB stick these days.
Yeah.
Would be the way to go.
Even that's like kind of old. There isn't, unfortunately, since everything's in the cloud these days, there's not really like an analog.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually to like a digital analog version, but I know what you're
saying.
Can
we make like a fleshy file and then like, you know what I mean?
And
then email it.
We're going to spend a lot of effort over the next several episodes trying to make as fleshy a file as we can here. I'm pretty stoked about this. I'm really genuinely excited because we're about to take a kind of Cronin journey. It sort of feels to me as I was prepping for this episode, like I am like the Gandalf in this relationship and you're like the Bilbo and I'm like pulling you out of a fleshy hobbit hole orifice and being like, let's go look at some stuff. You're going to see some things.
But it'd be end, Bilbo goes back to his hole and is like, all right, that was fine, I guess. And then the end of the story.
Yeah, fair enough. I'm curious to see how this stuff will actually hit you. For me, this is a journey through my childhood, and I'm really excited.
I don't have the nostalgia associated with it, so.
Right, exactly.
The fleshy cassette that we watched was Videodrome. Uh-huh. And, I don't know. I guess we should go into it. Do we enter the exposition drum?
Well, let me say just a little bit of forward-looking, you know, I wanted to do a, like, proper coverage of Cronenberg because we've joked about Cronenberg. You see references to it in Rick and Morty and things like that.
Yeah.
And, like, as I was sort of saying last episode, I was realizing that maybe when I talk about Cronenberg, just like, you know, when I talk about Lovecraftian or something, and there's even a funny conversation to be had about, like, what are the interesting overlaps and differences between Cronenbergian and Lovecraftian. But I wanted to make sure that we were all on, like, very much the same page when we understood what we were talking about here, because it's not just, like, weird tentacle monster kind of things. It is that,
sure.
But there's a lot more going on.
This is you, like, if you're a LARPer and you're explaining. It's not all running around and cat. Yeah, that's fine.
So we're going to go on, like, a quadrilogy or, you know, like, what is the four trilogy situation. We're going to watch four movies in a row of Cronenberg. It's funnier to not actually look it up.
Quadrilogy.
Right, exactly. So we're going to watch Videodrome. We're going to do them in sequential order, too, because I think they build.
So wait, was this the first Cronenberg?
No.
Oh, okay.
There are many Cronenberg movies. This is a four-movie series that I kind of think of as his peak transhumanism arc, right? Like, we're going to look at, like, the core of his work. There's other movies about, you know, other things about body horror. Some of them are even a little bit more straightforward as sort of, like, the history of violence and things like that is not sort of especially Cronenberg-y in the way that we tend to think of it. But what we're going to watch is Videodrome, The Fly.
Ooh.
Yeah, the good version, right? The updated version.
Wait,
and then
I don't know the different versions.
Oh, there's an old, like, classic black and white version, which is not bad.
Chef Goldblum is the
Goldblum version. Right.
That's the
we're gonna watch the Goldblum version. Yeah, for sure. And then we're going to watch, then we're going to take a break, because I think it's good to give you a break in the middle of this and do a Q&A, because we're due for one. And then we're going to talk about Naked Lunch, which is a movie that makes this movie seem normal by comparison. And then we're going to wrap it all up with Existenz, which is the fourth in the series and kind of a spiritual successor to Videodrome. And then I feel like everyone will understand when we talk about Cronenberg, and then we can go on to things like Brand New Cherry Flavor and other good sort of evolutions of this mimetic world.
Yeah, that's wow. It's like your masterclass.
Yeah,
Cronenberg.
I care deeply about the fleshy insights, so yeah. I think hopefully we can make this go. You know, we're shooting for like Dune level sort of peak of our own little corpus here.
All right, shall we? shall we intercept the pirate signal of the video drum now?
Do it. I want to hear Let's you explain it. What happened in this movie.
I was going to say the same to you, but okay. Let's bop it.
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
All right, so first off, on the Wikipedia, this was a massive loser of a movie. I didn't realize. $5.9 million budget, $2.1 million box office. So that's a flop. Interesting.
It's even funnier. Cronenberg turned down directing Return of the Jedi and
really?
Then made this movie. I'm not even kidding. He was incredibly
popular.
How would he have been?
Really? Wow.
Yeah. He was popular at this point. And
oh, man. Imagine the Ewoks.
Oh, and, yeah, exactly. I was like, there would be
the
so
Sarlacc
much more Ewok
pit.
Cannibals.
Oh, God.
Exactly. The second question is the Sarlacc pit, yeah. Right? How much more,
real
you know,
Sarlacc
Dick Gina could your Sarlacc pit get? But it would get there. It would be so fleshy and wet. So he turned it down because, like a proper artist, he didn't want to just do somebody else's work. Yeah. And then he went and made
then
this
he made
instead.
This, huh? Yeah.
And arguably, I think he made the right choice. I think this is a better movie.
Yeah. I guess it's hard to say, like, in an mm-hmm. alternate universe, it would be interesting what his Return of the Jedi would have been.
Oh, I absolutely played the alternate version in my head when I learned that little tidbit. I was
yeah,
like, yep,
so it's hard to evaluate for sure, but in retrospect, you know, I suppose uh-huh. a world in which just Return of the Jedi exists versus a world in which Return of the Jedi and this movie exists, I suppose that universe is better.
Yeah,
that's
fair.
Where they both exist. All right, so this is a very, very dated movie that
a very '80s movie.
Yeah, still nonetheless interesting. Little mm-hmm. interesting. I'm glad because the way you sold it and the way it started off, I thought we were just talking about some weird, like snuff film. Mm-hmm. You know, that one movie where I thought it was going to be just that kind of thing. But that's a little bit of a fake out.
Sort of
a fake out. And it's more about fleshy video cassettes, which is better than that.
Right. It does get weirder in a way that
it gets
like,
weirder.
It,
yeah.
Yeah. Right. It does
snuff
kind of
film
like,
is way more normal than what this.
Right.
Snuff film is the mainstream compared to whatever the hell is going on here.
I think you can see, you know, you can look at how like something like Sorry to Bother You, like the last act of that movie, like is indicative of the last act of a Cronenberg-y movie.
Yeah.
Right? Like it gets weird. Things get really weird.
Yeah. So we got the guy from Hercules, James Woods.
What? James Woods from right.
The movie,
from
the
Disney's
Hercules.
I was like,
yeah,
you're
Disney's
like, Kevin Sorbo? Wait, yeah. He said this is a different
no, this
conservative
guy's a way,
jerk. Now I'm confused.
James Woods is one of the more frustrating ones because he actually had some talent and went right wing.
Yeah,
you know, like
right.
Most of the right wing assholes in Hollywood actually never had any talent. But he's actually pretty good. He's a good actor, I think. Mm-hmm. And he's the CEO of a television station, and it's like in the future. I don't know what year it's supposed to be set in. Does it say?
It's the 80s. It's just sort of a
no,
perpetual 80s.
It's supposed to be set in the future from that. but I don't remember it.
I don't remember what the date is supposed to be. Yeah,
I don't see it listed anywhere. But needless to say,
it's a very kind of Philip K. Dick, you know, lo-fi future. Right?
It's not supposed to be like the year 3000, but I would, if I had to guess, in 1983, I feel like this was set in like 2000 or something. You know,
sure.
Like near future, and they got it right. They nailed everything. 100%.
There is an impressive amount of prescience in this movie,
a little
for
bit,
being honest.
Yeah, again, if you count the hits, you know, and forget the misses, there's some stuff in here. There's some themes that I think are good. But he's the CEO, and basically in the future in Canada. So is Cronenberg Canadian? I didn't know that.
Yes, Cronenberg is Canadian.
Gotcha. In the future in Canada, everything is so, like, it's that typical kind of, like, what's the word? Moral panic around violence on the media and stuff, but, like, to an extreme. So in the future, everything, it's just his television station is trying to find more and more extreme stuff to put on. Like, they can't even get extreme enough. It's just like porn. But then
he's doing the best he can in the 1980s to build Pornhub, right? He's trying his hardest.
There's a scene where there's like, this is pretty funny, actually. There's like an old lady who he works with that brings him stuff. People pitch him stuff to put on his TV show in the future.
Yeah.
His TV station.
I love this lady so much.
Yeah, she's got like normal porn. Like, it's like, I mean, there's, it's like a Roman orgy or something, but it's like porn. And he's like, come on, this doesn't cut it. And I love, it's like, that's so quaint. Like, this old lady, this poor old lady with her dated, like, yesterday's porno, you know, like, get out of here. It's kind of funny.
It's too soft. Yeah. We have like an oriental one at the beginning too, which like comes along with some great casual racism that I think is beautifully like aged in terms of like it fits with these characters so well.
Yeah. A little dated. So he's fine. And then like he just needs something more and more violent, apparently, because people just can't get enough of that. And then he, like, somehow the guy he's working with taps into, like, a hidden, you know, channel. Again, spoilers, that guy ends up being working.
Allegedly, right?
Working with the, who knows? I don't know. By the end of it, it's one of those movies where anything could be anything, and you never know.
Yeah, or does he factors in pretty heavily in all Cronenbergs, right? There's always an implicit, like, he taps into this thing, or does he?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he. It turns out later he just did all this on purpose, the guy he was working with. But it's Videodrome. It's this, like, super violent. It's basically just horrible snuff stuff. And, like, at first you think the movie's going to be like, oh, he discovers it's actually... Because he talks like, oh, the actors and how they find these actors. And then it's like, is this just like, it's actually real and that's the horror of this movie? And they kind of do that for a second, which I think is... I don't know, kind of boring. Like, that wouldn't be that interesting of a movie to have on Foster in Space, I don't think. But...
the torture porn movie?
Yeah, like, that's just the point of the movie. It would have been weird for you to choose. But instead, it's actually like, that was all hallucinations that people... you're going to have to help me with this. But it's like, the Videodrome is this technology that, like, the government, I think, or somebody, corporation maybe, I guess, is using... to control
you're
people.
You're doing really well. This is accurate.
And possibly it involves you need to, like, hallucinate, or you need to, like, yeah, there's that scene where how do we do this without skipping around the whole way? Basically, he's trying, all right, the movie becomes, he's trying to hunt down Videodrome. He has this weird girlfriend that I don't remember where she came from.
The radio talk host
lady. And then it
turns
out she never existed or something. I don't even know. Or does he? I don't know.
Or did and had died and had been, he'd been hallucinating a relationship with her by watching videos of
and
her.
And she's super SNME, and she's like into the Videodrome stuff. He's like, oh, wow, Jesus, like, you're hardcore. And she's like, I want to go be in Videodrome. And so, like I said, there's a bit of a fake out where you think the conflict is going to be, oh, no, she thinks she's going to go act in a show and then she's going to get killed on TV. Right. And then it's like, again, it takes a sharp turn because... he's trying to hunt down Videodrome. He manages to contact like this professor guy. What's his name?
Brian Oblivion.
Brian Oblivion, which is acknowledged as a fake name in the thing.
And with a great line about how in the future we will all have names that resonate with the cathode ray tube, which I thought was a perfect way to predict that, like, we all have our, you know, online personas and things now.
Yeah, that was interesting. Initially, I kind of skipped it, but initially he's on an interview, like a talk show, debating, like, hey, is
such a great scene.
To the two sides of, should you put torture porn on TV 24/7?
Yeah. Torture porn, good or bad. Yeah,
yeah, and problem? This guy is like a TV. He only appears through a TV on a TV, which is kind of, I love how back then the idea was like, yeah, you would have to film a TV. And that's the, and it's, he's eccentric because he will only appear on a TV screen on a TV, like Meta TV. But now that's how everyone just does TV. It's really funny. Like all we do, especially after COVID, is like all those Fox News bullshit, even the CNN one, you know, it's all there. Some of them, there's not even a person in the studio anymore. Like all those Fox News, sorry to get political for a second, but all those Fox News in touch with the working class people have their Manhattan, like, you know, massive flats or whatever, like where they have a studio from there that they are just like beaming in there. So that was pretty prescient in a way. Yeah, and like you said about his name, like that we'd all have these handles. Like me, for instance, I go by Thomas. Oh no, that's just my name.
Right. I wanted to put a pin in Oblivion because he's going to be the center of our philosophy today, because he's based on a philosopher named Marshall McLuhan, who Cronenberg actually studied with, apparently. And so, yeah, that'll be the philosophy focus. So it's good that we've dropped him into the conversation now.
So, okay, where are we now? As he's trying to hunt down Videodrome, somebody tells him somewhere along the, I think the old lady tells him that that Videodrome is somehow connected to Brian Oblivion. And so he goes to Oblivion's daughter's. Why is her name Bianca Oblivion, now that I think about it? Like, if his was an adopt, like, just a whatever name. Yeah. I mean, I guess she adopted his same name, but she doesn't live in a TV, like...
We find out almost nothing about her in this movie, if you actually think about it. She really is a cipher for most of the movie.
Yeah. So in talking to Bianca Oblivion, he kind of learns about Brian Oblivion being not really alive anymore. He died a while ago, allegedly. And it just exists on these cassettes. She has all these cassette tapes of him. And she kind of keeps him alive through that. That was fun. That was interesting. The idea that, like... That's not like the most implausible thing.
I mean, what we have now, right, is people. Yeah, deepfake people. There's a company now that will take files of your loved ones and give you a simulated virtual experience with them after their death. Wow.
I wonder if there'll ever be like a deepfake. Like, I don't know. Someone could pull that off. It actually wouldn't be hard.
Yeah,
not a deepfake of like, oh, make some famous person say something, whatever. Like, no, someone actually dies and they just deepfake them. I mean, we kind of are already doing that with every Star Wars product now that I think about it. That's just, I haven't even watched the latest one, but I assume it has like some sort of cameo of deepfake younger version of somebody. You know,
which is great because Marshall McLuhan has things to say about Star Wars.
Oh, good. Yeah, so that is also a little bit prescient. I'm trying to give as many points as I can, awarding points for prescience here.
One of my favorite lines in the movie also happens in this scene where she, you know, makes a comment that, like, she saw him on the television and she says, you said some very superficial things.
Yeah.
And that just to me was the funny, like, I totally want to drop that into as many, like, podcast conversations as possible. You said some very superficial things about this topic.
Yeah, that would be a good intro quote, by the way, I feel like.
It's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, somebody suggest that if you so desire.
It's going to be time for those soon, yeah.
And let's see. What does he learn there? Eventually, it's like someone... This other guy contacts him saying he's also in charge of Videodrome. I don't know. I honestly get a little lost.
Things get confusing. Yeah. And I can probably help you out
here.
Right. Well, because this is where, I mean, first of all, we're deep into like unreliable narrator territory.
Yeah.
Which is a you know, both Cronenberg and Lovecraftian
And I'll say because in retrospect... The first time he saw the broadcast, he possibly was like influenced into hallucinations. So
he's beginning to hallucinate.
Who knows what's happening here?
Right. Yeah. So who knows how much any of this is real? But what we sort of find out, what at least she tells us at this point is Oblivion discovered that there's some sort of like a kind of disease that affects people because of their lack of access to the television, to the cathode ray tube, right? Like CRT is actually the solution to the problem here. And that's why they're like, the church is full of people sitting there watching television. Oh, I thought that was just
the daughter's thing.
No, I mean, so like the whole kind of background theme about this is the way that technology is influencing our physical bodies and vice versa, right? And like the interconnections between them. And so, you know, what we kind of find out is Videodrome is kind of like a mimetic tumor is the best way to think about this, right? It's an idea become flesh. And so it burrows into somebody and replicates and spreads in this kind of way. And that's what the signal is that somehow.
But I should have talked about, I forgot that was before they walked through it. That's one of my, maybe my favorite part of the movie is when he goes to the Oblivion, to the daughter again, it seems to be her thing. She runs like, it's almost like a methadone clinic. It is like a methadone clinic. But for CRT, cathode ray tube, isn't that what it is? Something like that. And the idea, it's hilarious. It's both incredibly funny how dated and dumb it is, but also in other ways, it's great. Like the idea of being addicted and needing these things works. But the idea that we were going to be like so into CRT, like the worst television technology ever made that we instantly like moved on from as fast as we could. But it's still funny. So there's people who are like, I don't know, homeless or whatever, you know, strung out, and they get their little fix of cathode rays by watching these little TVs. That's like this community center of, I love that. I actually really enjoyed that scene.
Yeah, it is very clever.
There's also another later on, they sneak in another little thing about that where there's a homeless man who's got like a little TV, and it's almost like he's panhandling for like keeping the battery alive on this little TV for people to, you know, watch here or there because everybody's so addicted to the. It's funny. I thought that was a good touch.
Yeah, and it goes even sort of deeper than just like, you know, this is the opiate of the masses kind of thing. It really is this idea that like our physical biochemistry becomes connected to this thing, and if we don't stay connected to it, like some piece of us dies essentially, or you know. So yeah, and this is where we get into the weird conflict of the second half of this movie, which is this kind of shadow war that appears to be going on between the Team Brian Oblivion and like Team Videodrome, right? So what we actually find out is that Oblivion, rather than having started Videodrome, was actually in theory its first victim, right? The first person.
Okay.
He had a tumor growing in his head, right? Did you catch any that make any sense when
I caught
you were
that? I'm not sure why. So why did the old lady softcore pornographer say that Videodrome was connected to Oblivion? Was that like the bad guy kind of feeding her bad information, or is she like a, you know,
not entirely clear? I don't remember there being a reveal that explains why that happened. So it may just be that like, you know, like it may just be that like with her connections, all that she could find out was that there was some connection between Oblivion and Videodrome, which is true, even if the actual connection is much weirder than like, you know, he's running Videodrome. He, in fact, in theory, is trying to prevent the spread of Videodrome and is sort of running an alternative kind of cure to like the problem in a sense, or related problems or something maybe.
Okay, yeah, I think he was the victim because was he trying to fight against this technology, and that's why they took him out?
Again, it's not entirely clear, but at one point it sort of is suggested that like he had a tumor and he got it removed, and the tumor was Videodrome, and the tumor, and like it becomes a separate thing, and so he tried to resist it, and then they killed him. It seems to be as the way it's described as what happens.
Oh, well, wait, so like, then did he originate video? So then is it true that it came from him and then they like took advantage of it after it kind of came out of his mind?
Sort of. Yeah, okay. Basically that like, interesting. But like, again, this is all very weirdly meta, you know, like
And again, since we know it all, you know, we went past that point where everything could be fake. We're in the Vanilla Sky territory.
right.
of everything, which I kind of resent in some ways. I don't mind a little unreliable narrator, but I don't like when it's like, so I don't know anything that happened then. So I just watched a thing in which I have no idea if anything was actually real.
You certainly trend much more into the symbolic and metaphorical when you go in that direction, yeah, right? It becomes much more allegories and symbolism and whatnot.
I think there's a line. I think it's perfectly great to make use of that, but then, you know, like, I don't want to feel like I didn't actually watch anything happen. Like, I just watched, you know, like, oh, it could have been anything. Could have not happened. Could have happened. Could have whatever. It's a, for me, personally, that's my preference.
Yeah. Anyway. I agree with you in certain situations. I think in this particular movie, it doesn't bother me, like, you know, what is real in the second half of this movie. I just think it's such a fascinating ride to the sort of collapse at the end.
Yes, I think the middle of the movie is my favorite, and then the end is, I don't know. So, so he finds that out, and then, so how does he connect up with the bad guy is what I can't remember. Does that guy just find him and say, hey, I think I can take you into Videodrome or whatever, something like that, right?
Well, yeah. So, you know, he's getting some information and the guy who is in theory his subordinate turns out to actually be connected to Videodrome.
But he doesn't find that out until he's already met this guy, Barry Convex. That's what
I'm... Right. He also meets Convex at some point.
I don't remember. I think Convex just finds him. Like, he's hallucinating and I think Convex finds him or somehow he finds like the optical corporation, which is like a glasses store, but then the glasses I think are
right. He tracks down the glasses store and I mean the important thing here, right, is that in the midst of all of this hallucinating, he grows a giant weird fleshy vagina in the middle of his stomach. And
what's with you people and the making everything about sex organs? He grows a slot.
Oh, no, they call it a vagina. I'm not adding anything.
He grows in which you put a video cassette. Okay?
Technically a Betamax, but yes.
Is it? Oh, okay. Either way.
Because the VHS was too big and wouldn't fit in the fleshy vagina.
Oh, that's fair.
I'm telling you, though, they actually called it that. He grows this thing. And so basically what happens is, the Videodrome people think that they're using him to destroy Brian Oblivion, and he gets sort of turned as a double agent. And double agents are a reoccurring theme in Cronenbergian stories.
Well, they do use him. They do. This is where it becomes unclear to me. So they do brainwash him, and he goes to kill.
And he does.
He goes to kill the daughter, right?
Well, so he goes and kills his partners. And then he goes to kill the daughter, but doesn't. And she fixes him by using one of the televisions in her little place to counter program him. And then she gives him a better program.
So that was also unclear. I wanted to ask you what that was. Like, how does he goes to kill her because he's been brainwashed? He also, here's another thing I don't understand. We get a lot of TV. We didn't talk about the TV part that's like the sensual. You know, his girlfriend speaks to him through the TV, and then the TV is like pulsating.
The best use of air bladders in all of television history.
Yeah, I do love that quite a bit. That's great, great effects. Mm-hmm. Here's what I don't, and so I love the fleshy Betamax thing. Get it? Cool. It's weird. It's good. I don't really understand why his gun becomes a part of him.
Because a key theme in Cronenberg is the merging of idea, flesh, and technology.
Okay. I get that that could go with the theme, but in the movie, how does that make any sense?
Because I don't know. Like, what do you mean? How does it make any sense? by what framework weird fleshy mimetic nightmare would something make sense? Is in your criteria?
Yeah. Well, so. Again, there has to be a reason why anything isn't anything in a movie. Otherwise, you don't care about anything. If anything then who gives a shit?
I mean, my answers to questions like this are symbolic, right? It's like, I'm not going to give you a scientific explanation of Videodrome. What I'm going to tell you is...
Here's why I think it matters, is that I thought all the other stuff seemed to be related to... You know, our connection to TV and to that kind of technology, there's the rays that go in the head, the cathode, all that kind of technology. A gun is a 17th century technology. Like that feels like it's almost like a hammer.
Well,
yeah,
actually, still
I guess,
technology.
But
well, so
the idea that that's like connecting with, I don't know, to me that didn't really fit. Let me just finish with what I'm saying, and then I would like you to explain it. Yeah. That's why, to me, it didn't really fit in with the kind of the themes of the rest of the movie. But feel free to explain that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this does jump ahead to the McLuhan stuff a bit. But I think what he's going for here is tapping into this idea that all technology shapes us physically and alters who we are, and that it's not just television, it's also basic physical tools. And sort of McLuhan talks about extended self, similar to like what we talked about in Blindsight, for example, right? Where, you know, you become connected to the tool, the axe, the gun or whatever, and its features shape you. And so I think that's why, and in particular, violence. There's a lot of discussion of violent technology, but also violent media, and the way that that violent stuff in particular changes us as individuals.
Okay.
So the gun being a symbol of, you know, advanced violence in this way.
I hear you. That's a good explanation. I was going to argue with you until you brought the violence connection, and then it's like, yeah, okay. Because I guess my reasoning was like, well, then why now? Why, like, in this day and age, is the TV too far? And then that, therefore, in retroactively makes all technology combine with us or something. But, like, I think the violence thing is a good read there. That makes sense. But the gun has, like, bolted itself to his hand and is a Cronenberg-y fleshy hand gun thing, which is
super
cool. Is great.
Yeah, and we get like the weird fleshy grenade hand that the other guy has that blows up and kills him.
Yeah, what was that? I thought, I was like,
fleshy grenade hand.
Well, did he? You said he had that hand. I thought
so he put,
guy did that to him. I thought James Woods did that to him somehow or something.
Right. So what happened was he went to put another fleshy cassette into James Woods' vagina, and out comes the fleshy hand grenade instead of his normal hand.
So James Wood. James Wood is like, He's turned it on, so he's counter-programming.
Counter-memetics, exactly.
Okay, gotcha.
And then he goes and kills the other guy, who is, like, explodes into a bunch of tumors, because, again, Videodrome is literally, like, physically creating tumors in people.
Yeah.
And then it's like he runs off and I think kills himself to become the new flesh is the sort of best way to understand what happens at the end of this.
Oh, you're skipping the end.
Yeah, well, because we're 30 minutes. So
I was going to say, I was confused about how the girl counter programmed him instantly. And then she counter programs him to go kill the other guy, like the bad guy, right?
Right.
And so he does all that. And then it seems like he kills himself? Question mark.
Yeah, and there's no explanation exactly, like, what is the way that, like, the programming, counter-programming works here. We just get that image of, like, the gun coming out of the television screen and, like, fake shooting him or something. And it's sort of psychological warfare. You know, I just like it in terms of the idea of, like, there are these, like, these memes like running around and they can fight each other, and we're sort of just the battlefield in which these conflicts are playing out.
Yeah, that's a good image. All right, you want to do some philosophizing then?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's get started.
Why don't you go ahead and grok it?
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
It's wonderful, in fact, that we use things like Bopit and Grokit. I think McLuhan would be very, very much appreciate the use of pop culture memetic references in that kind of way. And Grok was a meme that I actually was asking my students whether they were still aware of in this day and age. But if you think back to Stranger in a Strange Land, they are unfortunately not. I told them to go ask their parents.
Really?
Yeah, it's gone. It's totally gone. And there's a whole conversation to be had about the way that the balkanizing of culture has meant that, like, our memes are all diluted in this kind of way.
Grok is dead, but lives on in the VHS cassettes of our podcast.
It's
alive now.
Yeah. So there's lots of stuff to talk about here. And really, in like, our discussion of the philosophy of Cronenberg is going to arch over all these different movies. But I wanted to talk in particular, like I said, about Marshall McLuhan, this guy who Oblivion is based on, because I think he sets up a lot of these kind of key themes that reoccur throughout Cronenberg's work. So this guy, Marshall McLuhan, he kind of... I actually watched a bunch of videos of him because he was on television. He was these like one of these pundit-y kind of guys. He was a Canadian philosopher from, you know, he was born in 1911, dies in 1980, you know, goes far enough that he's like making comments about Star Wars and things like that. So he's somewhat current in this kind of sense. And he really strikes me as like an early version of the modern pop guru, pop culture guru. Like he has a lot of very big brained kind of galaxy brain takes, and he has some pretty impressive, like, you know, hits, while also, in my opinion, having some like phrases and things that I think are a little bit, he himself acknowledges in one of the videos that like he kind of likes to take the piss out of people, essentially, that he likes to mess with people as a way to get them thinking. And so he's a bit trolly in some of the way that he portrays things. But for, you know, in terms of major hits, he's generally credited with predicting the internet in 1960. Like he basically predicts this idea of a digital web, but whereby individuals will pass along digital information in this direct kind of way. He also, you know, to some extent, I think, predicts the way in which the web, where social media in particular, would change us and would like lead to things like essentially cancel culture. So my sense of it broadly is that like he was very influential and popular, you know, in the like 60s, 70s, 80s period, and then kind of fell out of interest for a while, was considered sort of fringe for a while, and is now kind of having a resurgence because of like how much of his predictions about media and theory kind of stuff have played out. So his main ideas, the ones that are really important here, the first one is this phrase that he coined called "the medium is the message." Have you ever heard that phrase before? I had not actually.
I think I have heard "the medium is the message," but I'm not sure that I understood what it was meant to be.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I want to comfortably say that I understand what it means either. It's one of these kinds of, again, kind of almost guru-y phrases that has a, you know, debated meaning. Right. I do think there's something meaningful here, and the most common way I see it described is some version of the medium itself is more impactful on us than the actual content that it is providing. Mm. So basically, this is the idea that technology, information technology, changes us as human beings, and the change of the tech caused by the technology itself is much more profound on his view than whatever actual content is, you know, coming along with it. So the classic examples would be things like, you know, the written word, right? Once you have a literate society instead of an oral society, he argues that you have this move towards focusing on the visual field, right? More information focused through the eyes rather than through your other senses, that sort of thing.
Is it compatible? Because my first thought is like, I think the dichotomy, I think it's a false dichotomy of media versus message. I feel like it's, and let me know, this might be consistent with what you're saying, but it's like, it seems more to me that the media that determines which type of content we, you know, want to consume or that people, you know, gravitate to in a given media. Is that the same, or do you think that's like a different statement meaningfully?
So I think that's closer to this other thing that he was known for, which is this distinction he makes between hot and cold media. And again, this is another kind of thing where I feel like I don't fully understand the distinction, but here's my sense of it from doing the research for this episode. You know, the idea is that like different media impacts us in different ways, and in the ways that it engages like different degrees of cognition and different degrees of our senses or something like that. And it's a little confusing because what we would intuitively think of as being hot media, like television, I think, you know, you would assume that television would be this kind of media that sucks us in. It actually, they call it cold media, as far as I can tell. The idea being that the cool in cold is the hippie, not the hippie, but like the kind of counterculture idea of cool, right? It's the thing that really gets you going, that really kind of sucks you in. I don't fully love this hot-cold media distinction, if I'm being honest, and the attempts I saw to try to apply it felt a little iffy to me. But I do think that we can sort of broadly talk about this idea of like media that like potentially requires you to do more cognitive workload on your own versus media that, you know, especially like visual, certain kinds of visual kinds of media, you know, provide you so much of the content itself that you have to do very little work sort of in your own mind to complete, you know, to fill in the experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I guess that's one way to kind of differentiate. I mean, I guess I can't help but thinking about how in our day and age, how social media has tailored our content, you know, and it's just steers us toward the content that makes us the most angry in the quickest way, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is actually maybe, you know, again, I don't know how much I can criticize someone who I'm not super well versed in, but I do think there's a sense in which he goes a little too far in downplaying the importance of the content side of things and the relationships like you're describing, where, you know, what happens is the medium shapes our cognition in terms of it shortens our attention spans, for example. That's a classic modern idea of this medium. The medium shapes us as individuals, right?
Well, what do you mean when you say the medium? Because do you mean that there's an inevitable progression of media until it goes that direction? Because some media, you know, some different kinds of media would go the opposite way, right? Like if we lost all of the internet today somehow, like massive event, and we all had to read newspapers, that would steer us back in the other direction, I think.
Maybe. And that I think that's one way to interpret his discussions about things like hot and cold media. Now, I don't think he necessarily is arguing prescriptively that we should go one direction or the other. In fact, he's sort of, I think, in tension with conservatives who either would deny that these kind of changes to us as individuals take place. I saw that in one video where a guy was literally, I'm not kidding, arguing that like newspapers or modern technology or things don't actually change us as human, you know, organisms, essentially. I think he's more just about like trying to acknowledge that like these changes are occurring and we should be cognizant of what they are doing. I don't necessarily know that, but like so he does have this one sort of unpacking of his theory where he asks, you know, he suggests that for all mediums, we can ask the four following questions. What does the medium enhance? So, for example, you know, radio amplifies our attention auditorily or something like that. What does the medium make obsolete? So the move to radio makes print, you know, less important or something, or visual mediums less important. What does the medium retrieve from what had been obsolete earlier? So the radio brings back the spoken word in a way where it might have fallen away some because of the rise of typesetting and print media or something like that. And then finally, what does the medium flip into and push to extremes? So that last one is what I was thinking of, where you were talking about like, not all media has to go to an extreme, but it does seem that like certain medias do, because of their kind of coolness, pull us towards maybe potentially having certain kinds of content in them. So like, for example, to bring it back to Videodrome, you know, in that debate on the television, he defends himself as saying this is just a matter of economics. In order to survive, we have to get people something that they can't get anywhere else. So you might argue that like, in the proliferation of a media environment where, you know, everything is on the table in this kind of sense, there does become this inevitable pull towards more and more extreme versions of content. And this is where this becomes applied. I don't know that McLuhan, I didn't see anything in particular about him talking about, he talked about things like vicarious violence. I didn't find anything about him talking about violent and degrading pornography in particular, but that's clearly like where Cronenberg is taking this concept in this particular movie, right? In the applied, he's sort of asking, does Videodrome change us as psychosexual beings, right? Does it make us more prone to these sorts of violence in a way that like was a common sort of question, and I think it still is a common question for a lot of people. And, you know, I think it was very prescient in this movie, the way they have the discussion about like, You know, he basically says better to have this, you know, on the show rather than going on out in the streets or something like that. And we have, you know, a genuine concern about, like, are our minds compartmentalized in such a way where you can consume this kind of content and not have that spill over into your relationships?
Yeah, I thought that was what we were going to talk about, but I guess we've talked about that so often. I mean, that's the basic dichotomy that you always talk about between, you know, what are the two terms that I always forget the names
utilitarianism of? Utilitarianism and deontology or no?
Yeah, the idea that like virtue ethics kind of thing, like the habituating yourself. And I, you know, this movie, what do you think this movie says about that? Like in some ways,
yeah,
it starts off as though the evil, or not evil, I shouldn't say that. It starts off as though the graphic violent porn stuff is having an effect on society, but then due to this weird technology and the Videodrome like mind control thing, I actually don't know what ends up being true with that, or like what the movie ends up saying about that content, you know?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question, and I think it's one that I want to like leave open during our Cronenberg journey, is like, what is Cronenberg trying to tell us, if anything, about this kind of violent, you know, sexual pathos stuff, because it does pervade all of his material. And it's not as straightforward here as like that stuff is good or bad. I do think we have to think that he believes that it does change us. And like the question is, does he think it changes us for better or worse, or in some sort of morally ambiguous kind of way, maybe?
Because I think there's a, you know, I think it does make us a little worse in some ways, not in every case, but, you know, I think it is a percentages based thing. I think as much as anyone can sit there and be like, yeah, I could watch or play a super violent video game or watch a, you know, snuff film, and it doesn't affect me. Mm-hmm. And like, maybe that could be true. But I do think on, you know, given over the course of humanity, like it has a percentage effect. I feel like it has to. And I just don't think becoming comfortable or numb to just like awful violence could possibly be a good thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I think we're all sort of intuitively sympathetic to the idea that it would have that impact. And then several of us have a sort of skeptical response where we say, well, wait a minute, haven't we just walked into the like conservative narrative of violent video games and things like that? And then like, the data is questionable about those sorts of things. And so, you know, like we end up, do we, you know, should we be skeptical of that? And like to bring the McLuhan stuff back in, it's not clear even what I think McLuhan can actually say about that. If his view is really this thoroughgoing idea that it's the medium of television or the medium of the internet or whatever that matters more than the content itself, you know, can he really say that violent and degrading media matters any more or less than like, you know, the Aphrodite softcore stuff, right? It's not clear to me that it does make sense on that view. So I actually think, you know, that can't quite be right, that it does seem like the content has to matter, especially when the content is particularly sort of virulent and syncs up with a particularly virulent kind of medium, right? So take the example of, you know, memetics like QAnon on Facebook, right? You just have this like absolute firestorm of misinformation spreading across these communities, totally wrecking shop on people's, you know, ability to function normally. And like, I think we have to take that seriously as a version of this kind of Videodrome idea.
Yeah. And I think there's I do think there's also, well, now I'm kind of locked into that question of, does this stuff affect us? And I don't know if that's where you want to focus. So we can move on if you want to.
I mean, I think, you know, we can talk about it a little bit. I think we want, so I wanted to tie this actually to the show Euphoria of all places. I don't know if you've watched this show, another HBO show, that some people have accused of being a little too.
Yet.
Yeah, some people have accused it of being like a little bit too glorifying, as is often the case, like too glorifying of youth sexual drug stuff. I think if you watch the show, it doesn't actually come off very glorifying. It really comes off more like, train spotting or something like that, right?
Another thing I haven't watched.
Right, but I guess the question for me is, you know, can we make space in the world for stuff like HBO's, you know, many forms of his, you know, fairly violent historiporn, right? And how are those things meaningfully different from Videodrome? Is it just they have a little bit more of a plot or something like that? Like, what is our real way to argue for what I think is really genuinely valuable media, right? We get back into that question of, like, how do you distinguish, you know, valuable media that is changing us in a good way, that is promoting flourishing, from harmful media that is... Because, another big Cronenberg theme is that, like, the media that changes us is transgressive media. And so there is a value to some level of transgression of norms. And once you start down that path, you know, how do you justify continuing to be prudish, I guess, about the level of transgression or something?
I think there's, like anything, I think there's lines are tough to draw, but I mm-hmm. think there are real distinctions between something like, you know, a shooter video game, you know, which we could maybe argue about what effects that might have, versus something like Euphoria, which I haven't seen. I think I intend to see it. Is it good? Do you like it?
I like it. Yeah, it's, okay. It's one of those where we have to watch HBO, one episode a night, and that's it. We can't, like, binge it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'll get to that one. I do want to watch it. Something like that, or something that has some themes or whatever. Differentiate between that and snuff films. Like, I think, you know, the extreme, content portrayed in this movie, to me, it's like, I think there are lines to be drawn there. I mean, there's a reason why some of these extreme spaces like incel forums, you know, the like 4chan, some of those mm-hmm. places where there's a lot of angry men, extreme men, you know, they post a lot of that crap, or they spend a bunch of time watching like beheading videos, and it's this desensitization that I do think, you know, there's an extreme level of it that I have to believe is terrible for us. mm-hmm. but here's another thing about the video game thing. I don't think that the Christian right-wing view on that is correct. However, I don't know that we could say for sure with something like Grand Theft Auto or whatever. That was like one of the main ones that they cry about, right? The
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't think that Grand Theft Auto means that a bunch of kids are going to go, you know, carjack people or something. Mm-hmm. But I think it's an open question. There's a lot of sexism in those video games. And mm-hmm. I could easily see it having effect on sexist attitudes, like attitudes toward women. I think that's an open question, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think it's an open question, and I think it's an empirical question.
Yeah.
And a hard one to test.
One thing to set up the straw man extreme of like, well, if that isn't making kids go and shoot people and carjack, then it's not having effects. Like, well, okay,
right,
yeah, that's that version, sure, but like, you know, testing attitudes and seeing what effect it's having on some of these attitudes, that could be a real question.
Yeah.
And yeah,
I like to think about this question at a very kind of meta level by asking it about the movie Videodrome itself, right? This is a movie where they were genuinely, I think for understandable reasons, concerned that they were going to get an X rating, for example, or that like this might be a censored movie or something like that. Like, is this movie, you know, that has a lot of this pretty graphic stuff in it, part of the problem or part of the solution, right? Is this part of the Videodrome virus or part of like the O'Brien, Oblivion kind of cure?
Yeah, I don't know.
Mm. I think it's hard for stuff like this, right? I think Cronenberg's movies are quite brilliant, but I think you could certainly also raise concerns about things like the way they all tend to be centered around a transformative male experience that involves psychosexual violence towards women.
There are no good female characters in this. Maybe the old lady who sells Roman orgy porn. Like, that's the only good female character in this. And by good, I mean like, you know, not kind of one-dimensional in a possibly problematic way.
Yeah, I mean, so much of our work on this show unfortunately sits at the intersection of Cronenberg, Lovecraft, and Philip K. Dick, and all three of them are just absolutely awful about these particular kinds of issues. So I apologize on those particular fronts. Though I do think there are really good performances by women in these movies. There is a sense in which these are often the psychodramas of twisted men, right? Okay.
Well, we're kind of out of time.
I guess we're pretty much out of time, yeah. So I guess we'll save the rest of it for some After Darkie.
Ooh, sure. Plus, I don't know. I mean, oh, man. Audience or Aaron, anybody, I want to talk about Station 11 in the book versus the movie so badly, or the show so badly. Wow. When can I do that? How do I do it?
Random, throw that out. Okay. I didn't realize. I will get on reading it, and we can use that as a reward after you survive.
I mean, I don't know. Like, it's kind of a weird thing because I want to just talk about it, but I don't know that it's worth, you know, you have to read an entire book. Like, there's just some interesting differences.
I mean, I want to read it, so I'm curious.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. But okay. Well, anyway. So for all you people, for everybody who, you know, emailed or messaged
in the group
about the book, I'm becoming one of you now. I'm almost done with it. I love the book. I always intended to read it, and it's great, but it's very different.
Fair enough.
Anyway, all right, we'll do the things we do every week. What's our preview for next week?
Yeah, so our next step on our Cronin journey is going to be, as I said, Cronenberg's The Fly. This is such a beautiful movie, such great effects, such great... I feel like, you know, the acting and the special effects take another big step up between these two movies.
Yeah, okay, so here's the thing about The Fly. Yeah. I originally I saw this as a kid... because I went to a friend's house, I never would have been able to see it on my own at home or whatever. Mainly because we didn't even have any TV that wasn't the main like rabbit ear channels you can get. But I saw it at a friend's house what was that show that had the like scary skeleton thing? And then they showed scary movies on some channel. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, like one of those Tales
of the Crypt or something, is it?
Yeah.
What's Tales of the Crypt? Is that it? It's something like that.
No, Tales of the Crypt was a different thing.
Like
Elvira
that.
Kind of show or something
No, it wasn't that. Anyway, it had some host that like, you know, would crack jokes along the way, but they were showing the scary movies. And as a kid, it was just like a terrifying movie, you know? I saw that as a... So that's the instance in which I most like you is that I saw that movie at a pretty young age. and pretty terrifying.
It's certainly the most mainstream of any of the things we're going to be watching here in the near future. So that's not totally surprising that it would be the one that you have some experience with.
Fine. Can't let me have that one, huh? I'm just a normie.
I'm right
still.
There with you. I'm very proud of you that you were traumatized by The Fly, and that's good.
A little bit.
A little bit,
but probably for different reasons than you might think. The Terry monsters, as my son calls them, aren't really the key for me. It's more the psychological components. But right, so let's see what our top patrons are making you say this week.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you, but as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong merging squishily with the AI patrons. Shut up, baby. I know it. Gabby, Gabs, Gabster, Big
Shut up,
Easy
baby,
Blasting.
I know it.
that's a good shout out. OperationBrowniePockets.com is a free game you play in real life. Aaron has to read this weekly, but Thomas only bi-monthly. Explain this deontologically. Dude, Corey Ebert, I embrace the void. Now, philosophers in space, my brain is hurting. That's good. Any election lawyers want to pioneer a case on the California Fair Maps Act? Jess Rabinowitz and Brenda Goodman, Chad T, and the official Siege Planning Committee, North Carolina Division, and all the thanks to our definitely not a very fleshy clone patrons. So, Left Hand of Darkness, sometime soon, and Blorco number 5.
Blorco number 5. So good.
Speaking of the Blorcos, there's been some like new Doctor Strange trailers coming out, and all of Twitter is just like, was that Blorco, Blorco, Blorco?
Yeah. Are they new, or are they the same one that was at the end of Spider-Man?
I don't know.
Turn Off the Dark or whatever the movie
Everybody's
was.
Pretty sure they saw a famous person as a new Blarco.
A new Blarco, huh? New Blarco just dropped.
We can use that now to avoid spoilers. We can just, yeah. It's great.
All right. Good times. We're going to be off to the After Dark here. Join us, patreon.com/0G for this After Dark, or we'll see you next week.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/0G. You can find us on Twitter at @0GPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.